All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 13 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the Elementary Class. We are talking about our connection to archaic Egypt, and today we're going to see what that connection is specifically. And it has to do with the fact that modern Europeans created a science to study archaic things. So we have this word, why don't I use the chat, because I so rarely use it. We have this word archaic, referring to these things that are so ancient, but also basically not really considered useful and not really maintained as ideas or values today, as opposed to things that are classical. So we have this word archaic, and then we have a science for the study of archaic things that was created by Europeans called archaeology. Okay, and so this is what's going to help us to, well, let me bring this up here as I share my screen. The study of archaeology is the thing that's going to help us to bridge this gap so that we can create a Portolan chart for ourselves in which we have a connection that we can identify and understand to ancient or archaic Egypt. So this is the science of archaeology that's going to give us that. And it's going to give us that because of this character named Napoleon, who is going to get Europeans who are interested in archaeology out of Europe into this other place, into Egypt. And Napoleon is going to, here's a picture of Napoleon standing at the base of one of the pyramids, I guess, right? And here he is looking on, and some workers, including some of his, you know, European scientists and archaeologists, have uncovered a sarcophagus, and you can see that they've unwrapped the mummy. And there, you know, Napoleon is standing there kind of looking at it. What's one amazing thing about mummies is that this technique of mummification really preserved the body to quite an amazing extent. So, which is why you have this kind of corpse here, which even though it might be thousands of years old, still has the kind of skin on it. And it's pretty gruesome, but it's pretty fascinating. So Napoleon brought these characters to Egypt, not just his army. We know he wanted to conquer Egypt and then go on to India because his enemy, his greatest enemy, was England. And the English were starting to build their empire in India. So Napoleon brings all these characters to Egypt, and they start to unlock the mysteries of archaic Egypt. But there was one huge barrier, and that barrier was the language barrier. They could not read any of these sorts of things, right? These diagrams that you find everywhere in all the most important Egyptian monuments, especially, of course, the pyramids and other temples, they just couldn't read it. So this is where we get to this most important discovery in all of what we call Egyptology, the science of the study of ancient Egyptian culture. And the discovery occurred in a place called Rosetta. So hopefully everybody has done their geography work, so that when I say where Rosetta is, you know where it is. And we have Rosetta here in class. She has a special connection to ancient Egypt. And I think you told me once before, Rosetta, were you named in any sense after the Rosetta Stone?
Not really.
No, it's just a nice name, kind of like the name Rose, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's just a pretty name. So, but anyway, it's a cool fact that it just happens to also be the name of this particular object that was found here. Now, I want to explain a little bit about this map of Egyptian geography to make sure everybody understands it. Modern Egypt has these straight line borders. Now, this is something interesting about modern countries. and in general about human activity on Earth when it comes to whether or not you see straight lines. So you have these straight lines going straight through the desert. But back here, the borders of Egypt were pretty much these green lines. Why was that? Why was Egypt not this whole, you know, big modern country that we know today? Why was Egypt basically just this? Who has a thought about why this was the shape of ancient Egypt, basically? Julia? Go ahead, Julia.
Because of the Nile River?
Yeah, because of the Nile River. I mean, all the rest of this modern Egypt here is a desert. People can't live there unless they have a lot of advanced technology. And nowadays, you know, there are spots where people do live in the desert consistently because of technology. But back in ancient times, there wasn't any technology to sustain life in the desert. You moved through the desert if you were a nomad, but you got to an oasis or you got to places where you could survive. And here's a really great illustration of why ancient Egypt is drawn the way that it is on your map of ancient Egypt. Take a look at this. This is about as cool as it gets because this is a satellite photograph of Egypt. And it shows you the massive desert where nobody lives. But then look at this shape in particular up here. Does anybody know what that's called? It's in the shape of a fan. Opal?
The Fertile Crescent.
Say that one more time, please.
The Fertile Crescent.
The Fertile Crescent. Okay, right. It is that is actually a name for another part of it. This is what we call the mouth of the river. Right, where it opens up into the sea, or I believe it's also called an alluvial fan, because it's in the shape of a fan. Okay, and you can see that it's all green here, and it's all green along the river, because the river provides the water that the plants need in order to grow. So if we look up in this part of Egypt, for instance, which is pretty cool, now we zoom in here. Look just how green it is. It goes from being a desert to being this incredible, lush, beautiful place to live. Really one of the easiest places for human beings ever to live. In ancient times, when people didn't have modern technology, they lived along rivers. Because rivers give you the water that you need in order to grow plants, in order to drink the water that you need as well. Opal, go ahead.
But it's not all by the river. There are some things going way out where there's no river.
Well, actually, that's just the thing. An alluvial fan is a spot where, and I'll show you this, there are multiple channels to the river. It breaks up, and the river spreads out over this entire area. So if we try to zoom in a little bit more, you can sort of see here, this is about as well as we can do with it, but you can sort of see, I'm going to highlight it, part of the Nile River, so it's coming in over here, and so it's coming in down here, and you can see that part of it's breaking off and going over here. Okay, so that's part of the river, but you can also see that there's a channel of the river going over here. And there's another one going over here, and I think there's one right there. And see, that's the thing about this alluvial fan is basically it's small parts of the river breaking off and going off in all directions, which is why this whole area is green, because the one large river breaks up into a lot of small channels. Opal, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I've never done that.
All right, fine. So if you look at a map, for instance, of New Orleans, down in Louisiana in the United States, you'll see a very similar thing because the Mississippi River is in one big channel for a long time. And then when it gets down to the Gulf of Mexico, it breaks up into a whole bunch of smaller rivers. And there's a whole area there that's very lush because of that as well. Okay, so that's kind of the way it works. And Rosetta is somewhere here. I'm not a total expert on the geography of it. But actually, these gray parts are almost certainly cities as part of, all the settlements. And then this massive gray part over here is the biggest city in Egypt, which is called Cairo. So all of that probably is on your map, and that's good. So we got, modern day Cairo is here, right? And then you have I showed kind of two channels of the river. There's more than that. And Rosetta's way up here in this area over here. All right. So this is starting, now we're starting to see a little bit of the use of doing our geography maps, because when I tell you that an important object, or another word for that is artifact, an important artifact was discovered in Rosetta, well, you don't just have this word, right? You know that the word Rosetta is the name of a place, and you know where that place is. All right, so now let's go to the actual Rosetta Stone. And this really, well, of course, we'll learn about all of these other ancient locations, by the way, as we are doing Egyptian history. So you're going to want to keep this map handy, because it definitely is useful for marking the location of important places in Egyptian history. So let's go look at the Rosetta Stone now. Go back to this here. Oh, yeah, by the way, look at this. This is also awesome. This is the region at night. And look at the Nile River Valley. Isn't it amazing? So that's where, see, there's some places where people have settlements in the desert, right? But hardly at all. On the other hand, the Nile River Valley is just this incredible snake of light at night. Really quite amazing. Yeah. All right. So I love satellite photographs of the world at night, because you can see all the places where civilization exists. And there's a lot of really dark spots too, and it's quite amazing. So it's just fascinating to see the differences there. All right, so there's Egypt at night. And so we got Rosetta here, and this then is the Rosetta Stone. Okay, we're going to look very closely at it, because it has some very interesting things. The Rosetta Stone is called a stele. Let me go ahead and write that down in the chat box as well. So a stele is spelled like this, but it's pronounced more like, you know, stele, like this. Okay, because we say both E's, like long E's. So it's a stele, which is a large stone with a flat surface like this. Okay, a large stone with a flat surface. How big is it is an interesting question. You're going to have to look it up, because I'm not sure. I think it's about a yard across, or about a yard, each one of these is maybe about a foot deep, or maybe a little bit more, about that size. And so the thing about it is, notice that there are three different sections to it. Three different sections. This one up here I'm going to go ahead and zoom in now. Let's go take a closer look. Okay. This section up here is the type of writing that we find in these writings here on the walls in Egypt as well, right? In the temples. So that's called hieroglyphics. Okay. And then, but there's two other kinds. There's a writing in here that modern people did not know how to read either. And there's a writing form down here, which I'm going to zoom in on just a little bit more. Yeah, I'm sure it's lagging a little bit, so it'll get caught up. It's not my screen, it's the internet that's laggy. So here is the writing, and you might be able to recognize letters like A, O, E, and things like that, as it turns out, because this is a form of writing that's very similar to the one that we use today. This is ancient Greek. And the Greek alphabet was very similar to our alphabet. So this was something that's very interesting. There was this stone object found in Egypt, and it had three different kinds of writing on it. Ancient Greek, and then two different kinds of Egyptian script. So why was this such an interesting thing? Well, what the discoverers of the stone realized was that whoever had made this, they didn't know who it was yet, whoever had made this had wanted to write the same thing in three different ways. Intriguing. Why would you need to do that? Why do you need to write things in three different ways? Julia?
So you can translate it?
Well, not so much. I mean, translating just means comparing different languages and using one language to know the other. That's not why it was made with three different forms of writing. So if you go into a bathroom and you see a sign that says, wash hands and then lavas manos or something like that, right? Why is it written in two different languages? Opal?
So people who speak different languages can understand.
Perfect! So that meant that somebody in Egypt needed people to understand what they were saying in Egyptian writing and Greek writing. Huh, interesting. Alright, and so we're going to learn about the history of Egypt that helps explain this fact. Turns out that the Greeks had conquered Egypt and they were ruling it. I think I might have mentioned that Cleopatra was one of the ancient Greek rulers of Egypt. So the Greek rulers of Egypt wanted to communicate to their own people in Greek, but also wanted to communicate to the Egyptians in the Egyptian forms of writing. Julia, go ahead.
Do we know what the Rosetta Stone says?
Yes, we do. And I'm going to get to that shortly. Right, because otherwise it wouldn't be such an interesting object, right? I mean, this is the bridge between us and archaic Egypt. So, yeah, the only way that it's going to be such an important object is if we actually figure it out. So, like I said, people in Europe knew how to read Greek, because that was a classical language, and people who studied history learned classical languages. Thomas Jefferson knew how to read Greek. Wasn't an expert, but like a lot of the founding fathers, he knew how to read this Greek. So this was a classical language, one that was still alive, and people who were educated learned how to read it in places like Europe and America. So they knew how to read this, so they could figure this out. And then what they did was they started to make, like Julia was mentioning, a translational dictionary. So what they would do is they would look over here and they would find a word, and they would look over here and they would find that same word, and then they would find that same word over here. And then you know what they would do? After having found that word in certain locations in the Greek script that they knew very well, what would they do? They would look for the same... Well, Rosetta, you tell us.
Look for the same words in the Egyptian language.
Yeah, they would look for the pattern repeating in the script in the Egyptian version of it and find that pattern in different places. And that was, it turns out to be quite a complicated job. It was pretty easy to go from, well, I won't say easy. It actually took 15 years to figure out from the Greek stuff to this stuff, which is called Demotic. The one most people know about hieroglyphics. And it actually needs a capital D. Demotic. And it's kind of interesting because it also comes from the word demos. More a language of the people. The language up here, hieroglyphics, was the language of the priests and the rulers. So not everybody knew this written form. It was special. It was reserved for the most important people in the society. Demotic, on the other hand, was used for practical matters in government, used for businesses and stuff like that. So people who were educated, there were not many, because most people were illiterate in ancient times, which means they couldn't read or write. But enough of them, the important ones in the society, would use this form of writing. And as it turns out, it's more efficient and it's kind of a better form of writing than the picture writing of hieroglyphics. So they learned how to do this. It took about 15 years for Europeans to learn how to read this part and then go up here and build a translation dictionary to work on this part. Let me show you a little bit of what a translation dictionary looks like. This is not the one I want. Just excuse me for a sec. Oh, I guess I got to bring... There we go. Here's kind of an interesting page on Wikipedia that shows you kind of how you start recognizing the combinations of characters. One thing that they had to do also was use an Egyptian writing, a modern Egyptian writing called Coptic as a bridge. Really complicated stuff. And you can see how this symbol looks like this symbol. And this symbol looks like this symbol and so on. Right? Much more so than these, which are hieroglyphs. So it takes quite a long time to build up a translation dictionary and then figure out how to read the hieroglyphics. And the man who finally did learn how to read the hieroglyphics, his name was Jean-François Champollion. Here he is. Handsome guy with a good beard. And he finally translated the Rosetta Stone about 23 years after it had been discovered. So finally the hieroglyphs were written, where the hieroglyphs were figured out. And the most important thing that he figured out how to do is this. If we go over here and look at the hieroglyphs part, wait till the lag gets that hieroglyphs part onto your screen. And I want you to notice that on this, in this writing system, there's every once in a while, there's a special thing. What do you notice is different about the symbols in that particular spot compared to the other spots? Why does that look more interesting? There's another example of it right here. What's different about those ones, Rosetta?
Because it's an oval shape.
Yeah, it's surrounded by an oval shape. And what Champollion figured out was that whenever there was an oval shape, it was the name of the pharaoh. It was the name of the ruler. And this is called a cartouche. Let me show you here. If you Google cartouche, okay, and Egyptian hieroglyphs, a cartouche is an oval. And it indicates that the text enclosed is a royal name. So whenever you see a cartouche in hieroglyphic writings, you know that it's the name of a pharaoh. And then that helps you to figure out the rest of the sentence, right? Because when you're diagramming a sentence, you need to know where the nouns are, right? And then you figure out the verbs and you figure out the adjectives and all that other stuff, right? If you're learning grammar, you need to know the parts of speech. So a cartouche is very helpful. So when Champollion figured out the cartouches, well then guess what? You go back to the museum and look over here on the wall. What do you guys see? Cartouches. So who is this guy who's feeding ice cream to the rest of the Egyptians? Whatever he is, his name is on the cartouche, right? Rosetta? What is that? You didn't want to say that. Okay, so this became very important. This was part of the, you know, the Rosetta Stone was the key to figuring this all out by translating the cartouches and then translating the other elements of the writing. It took Champollion, by the time 1822, I believe, was when all of this was finally understood. Did you have a question?
Not now.
Not now? Okay. So, Julia asked, well, what was written on the Rosetta Stone? So, what Champollion discovered was that the Rosetta Stone was dedicated to a pharaoh named Ptolemy V. You can see here that it mentions him. The Rosetta Stone was produced during his reign as an adult. So, but Ptolemy V was the pharaoh. It's a Greek name because he was part of a Greek dynasty. In fact, he's Ptolemy the Fifth. The first of the Greek rulers of Egypt was his great-great-grandfather, Ptolemy the First, who was one of Alexander the Great's bodyguards. So we're going to go back and study Egyptian history, of course, and connect it Greek history and connect it to Egyptian history. We'll see that Alexander the Great conquered Egypt. And that after that, one of his bodyguards, Ptolemy, became the ruler of Egypt after that. And from then on, Egypt was ruled by the Greeks until it was ruled by the Romans and so on. So Egypt kind of gradually disappeared as its own culture while it was being ruled by others. And so Ptolemy the Fifth was the ruler whose name is featured in the cartouches on the Rosetta Stone. And basically what it said was, he's a great guy. Isn't he a great guy? He's the best ruler ever. He gives lots of money to the priests. He builds temples. And he does things that good Egyptian rulers are supposed to do. So basically, the Rosetta Stone was a big, kind of like a celebration of the great deeds of Ptolemy the Fifth. A way of telling the world that he is such a great guy. So, most people don't know that about the Rosetta Stone and don't care because it's all part of archaic history, which means, sorry, buddy, we don't really care if you gave a lot of money to the Egyptian priests because it doesn't matter to us anymore. But what does matter is that your Rosetta Stone helps us to understand about other Egyptian things. So at least we can be thankful for the fact that it was created in order to try to make us think that this guy was so great. And then it was discovered later on by Europeans who then were able to translate it. And because of that, as we're going to see tomorrow, the archaeologists and historians can learn, for instance, about something like Menes Narmer. And they can start to put together the history. They can understand that Egypt gets its start around 3000 BC, and the whole story starts to come together, and we can figure it out. We'll see that on that other object that we're going to look at tomorrow, which is called the Narmer Palette. When we look at that in detail, we'll see hieroglyphs. And we'll see hieroglyphs and all the writing concerning the rulers of ancient Egypt. And that's the key that Ptolemy the Fifth's Rosetta Stone was the single most important object in terms of solving the mystery of what all of this says. All right, good. So, as a result, here's going to be our new timeline. We are going to add a new anchor fact to our history of the ancient world, because our Portolland chart is, it's incomplete, right? If we don't have some kind of new mark over here, then basically we will never be able to navigate back to Egypt. So the mark that we need is something that helps us to understand, make sure you mute yourself, something that helps us to understand the fact that we can navigate to ancient Egypt. So here we go. Our new anchor fact timeline with the extra crucial anchor fact that from now on we are also going to add to our list, which is called the Rosetta Stone, and it was discovered in 1799. Okay, so now we can navigate, right? We can go from Menes Narmer, from us. What we can do is, you could say, well, because we're basically coming from Europe over here, we can navigate all the way back to Menes Narmer. So it's very indirect, okay? America doesn't come from Europe. It doesn't come from Egypt, but it comes from Europe. And the Europeans built a bridge from themselves to Egypt, which means that we can cross that bridge too, and we can get to ancient Egypt. Oh, so now we're getting that connection. All right, so our Portaland chart is more complete than ever. So we'll keep filling it in with new anchor facts. And what I'm going to do tomorrow or Monday, see which one I decide on, is I'm going to start getting you guys ready for the test. Because one of the things that you're going to do on the tests is you're going to be responsible for navigating this Portaland chart. So on the test, you're going to get Portaland chart like this of history, and it's going to be empty. And you're going to have to fill it in. And then if you're a real expert, I'll give you a completely empty one. Oh, like that. Well, I'll give you one that's not quite that empty. I'll give you one that has the gray dotted lines. And then if you really want to be an expert, you have to draw it from scratch. But that might be something for anybody that's in the upper elementary that wants to really get a good challenge, then you'll be able to do that exercise. But usually I will give you the colored lines and I will put a little place for you to write an answer so that you know that there's something that you need to be labeling, and then you'll be filling it in. And that will basically be the first page of any test that you take from now on. So you guys are going to become experts in navigating to the ancient past. Okay, very good. So like I said, tomorrow we'll get to Menes Narmer. We'll look at the actual hieroglyphic tablet that illustrates his conquest of Egypt, his unification of Egypt. And then we are going to then we'll do the test once we have all of that in hand. And then we'll get to the story of the archaic world. Now, I see that Wyatt and Henry have had their sound issues. Do you guys want to ask a question or make a comment? I know that I might be late on this. Go ahead, guys.
Can you hear us?
Yes. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I got to that at the very end of class when there's really nothing to do. Okay. So, anyway, next time, hopefully, I'll do better than that. Okay. Thanks, everybody. That's it for today. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.
Bye.